they did the usual scan, you know, show us your belt, give us your watch. And then they said, there's something in your pocket. And I pulled out these plastic pens. I mean, you know, they're felt tip pens. You couldn't do much damage with it. And the guy said, you got to give me your pens. And I said, but I can't write without these pens. I was like, it's the only way I know how to write. Sorry. Can't. So I ended up having to do this interview at ballpoint.
Well, they say, David, the pen is mightier than the sword. So maybe they were, maybe they were worried about that.
The felt tip revolution needs to come to Zelensky's office.
This is Impromptu from Washington Post Opinions. It's a brand new show where we take you into the conversations behind the columns. We have a lot of people here with a lot to say, so each week you'll hear different voices depending on the news of the moment. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor, and today we've got a very special episode. Two of my colleagues, David Ignatius and Jim Garrity, have just come back from Ukraine, and we thought this would be a good opportunity to check in about the state of the war over there, especially as American aid to Ukraine remains in limbo in Congress. David, Jim, thanks for joining me.
You bet.
No, thanks for having us.
So it's been over 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine, and both of you have been there multiple times. Can each of you give us a sense of the current mood among ordinary Ukrainians, and perhaps, David, maybe even how it's a little different from what it was on the other trips you took?
This was my fourth trip. I was last in Ukraine in October. And at that time, I had a bad feeling. I wrote that Ukraine felt like it was bleeding out, for the first time since the war began, I was hearing some real political debate, controversy about the best strategy forward. This time, I felt things had steadied a bit. I met with the head of military intelligence, General Budanov, and I spent a good long while with President Zelensky. So in a sense, I'm hearing the, you know, what the leadership wants to say, but people were looking the situation deeply worrying for them that the United States isn't a reliable provider of aid in the eye and trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to do about this? They're making a lot more drones. We'll talk about that later in the show. But in general, I'd say this trip, compared to the last one, a little steadier footing.
Chuck, I'd say a lot of what I experienced aligns with what David said. My last trip was in August. The counteroffensive had kind of just gotten started, and there was not a real clear sense of how it was going at that point. I think we can now all say the counteroffensive did not achieve what the Ukrainians were hoping to achieve. I came away from the first trip. People would ask me, you know, so what do you think? And I'm like, well, I don't know if the Ukrainians will win the war, but I know they're never going to quit. That every last one of them was like, we are going to get these bastards. We're going to kick them out of every square. They use metric over there, every square centimeter of our land. We're going to kick them out of Crimea. I don't get any sense of the Ukrainians wanting to quit based on this trip, but I do think there's a sense of the task is daunting. There's a recognition of the sheer scale and difficulty of what they have to do. And as David said, you know, everything's a lot harder when the U.S. is not keeping the arms flowing the way they were before. I think my favorite quote of the entire trip was from Marian Zablotsky, a member of the Ukraine's parliament. He's a quote machine, so he's got a lot of good ones, but one of them is like, so what's the attitude of the troops in the field? He says, well, the morale is better when you get to shoot back. And, you know, that because of shortages in artillery shells and other ammunition in some parts of the front, they're firing one or two shells for every 10 that the Russians are shooting. So it's a small miracle they've managed to hold on to the territory that they have. And they, you know, but they're following Congress very closely, which is, you know, as if they didn't have enough to worry about.
It sounds like both of you encountered a lot of, sounds like grim realism. David, you interviewed, as you said, President Zelensky. Tell us a little bit more about that encounter and the sort of the atmospherics of meeting him after 2 years where he's been a war leader.
So when you want to go see one of the senior officials, you go into what's called the presidential compound. You walk up a hill and get to a heavily barricaded checkpoint. They've got your passport details. You go through that, and then you walk through an area that's eerily deserted. I never know whether this is ground zero, you know, the prime target in Ukraine, or it's actually the safest place in town because the Russians don't actually plan to to kill Zelensky. I had an escort walking with me. You walk circuitous way, not the main entrance to the presidential compound, but a kind of back door. Everything's sandbagged. I mean, they think that they might get hit, so you walk in and the windows are sandbagged. You go up the stairs. There's a big barricade heading up to the boss's room. I had sat in an ante room waiting for Zelensky to see me, and it was eerie. Everybody remembers that scene in 2001, A Space Odyssey, when you kind of come to the end of the universe and you're sitting in this perfect room, you know, sort of French Louis the 14th furniture, and everything's just out of time. It felt like that. We sat there for a long time. But, you know, he just seeing him, he's such an iconic figure. We feel we know him. We know just how he looks and moves. To be there with him, to see this, kind of, he's a quality. He's got a little bit of a roust about it. He's still a character who might be an actor, but as I wrote in my piece, playing this part so brilliantly, immediately speaking to the question at hand: what happens if you don't get the aid from Congress? And he gave a straight up answer. If that happens, we will have to begin to pull back. And he pulls out a piece of paper and he draws me a little map of the battlefront. And he says, you know, here's our line. The only way we can preserve this line is to shrink it, because we don't have enough artillery to protect the whole line, which means we're going to have to retreat step by step. You know, it was really extraordinary to hear him say that, and then to hear him say the only way we really can protect ourselves is to do to the Russians what they're doing to us. They're taking out our energy grid. They're trying to black out our country. We're going to have to do the same thing to them. They have to feel that same fear, or we have no deterrence against their weapons.
Jim, I wanted to get your take on the question about the $60 billion aid package that's been held up in the House, as Speaker Mike Johnson is trying to wrangle the far-right anti-Ukraine Republican members. Tell us what you were hearing from Ukrainians about that point and how closely they're paying attention and what their assessment is of how they would fare with or without that military aid.
Badly. Very, very badly. I got a very direct quote from a woman I spoke to who's worked as a translator, Miroslav Luzina. I asked, if you had a message for Americans, what would you tell? And she just immediately started talking to Mike Johnson and said, I would want to tell the obstacle. Like, that's how he's referred to over there right now. So there is a very clear sense that without American support, this war is going to get a lot tougher really quickly. There's been an effort in Europe to try to make up some of the slack. The Czech Republic has always been very active in the arms sales, and they're doing everything they can to get as many 155-millimeter shells. Apparently, Denmark said they're turning over their entire supply of artillery shells. But, you know, the hole left by the lack of U.S. support in the last 6 months or so is a really big hole to fill. And I don't think it's reasonable to expect the Danish to single-handedly step in and fulfill that. And it's kind of deeply frustrating if you, particularly if you're an old Cold War kid like myself, to believe that, like, look, we don't want to help people fight Russians when they're invading. Really, that's what we're about these days. But that's, we live in strange times.
Ukrainian technology is the X factor in this war. They're thinking, what if we don't get the aid from the U.S.? What do we do then? Do we all just die? No, they're going to fight back. Ukraine on its own is developing really quite extraordinary drone technology. They're building drones out of cheap plywood almost. They're converting furniture factories, believe it or not, to make the airframes, and then they're putting modern electronics into the drones. The key is to keep the costs of the drones down, because they just got shot down so easily. And they're incredibly effective. Essentially, drones are beginning to replace artillery in this war. And they're doing one other thing that's really interesting, because it is going to make Russia bleed. They are building their own longer-range drones. I talked to a drone builder who was building one with a range of well over 1,000 kilometers. That reaches pretty deep into Russia. And they're getting to the point where they'll have long-range drones that can get to Moscow and do damage. They've taken out refineries with some accuracy. The electronic warfare aspect of this war is enormous, and the Ukrainians are going after it much more aggressively. That's one of their messages to the U.S. The Biden administration gets really nervous when they see refineries going up in smoke, not least because the price of oil might go up. The Ukrainians say, basically, sorry, this is our only opportunity to fight back, and we're going to keep doing it. Zelensky said to me, they're taking out our energy infrastructure. We're going to take out theirs. It's fair. Yeah, and that's the way they look at it.
And if you don't supply them with the aid, you don't have any say in how they use their military weaponry anymore.
Exactly. They say, we built these drones. Don't tell us how to use them. They're not your drones. They're ours.
Jim, your chair is kind of squeaking, but yeah. If you want to go ahead and...
It was actually my thoughts getting ready to burst out of my head, because I actually had the opportunity to tour a ground drone facility somewhere in Ukraine. I was not allowed to say where it was. In addition to doing landmine laying, which I realize a lot of folks in the West are not big fans of, they can transport the wounded, they can explore, reconnaissance, all kinds of abilities. And there's a jamming technology that worked 3 months ago that is now outdated, that we're seeing the future of warfare utterly transformed in Ukraine. And apparently they have videos of Ukrainian soldiers holding up their jammers as the drone comes in and belatedly realizing it doesn't work, that the Russians have developed a countermeasure that stops it. And that's the last thing these Ukrainian soldiers ever see. So apparently 3 months is how long it takes to go from, we've got some amazing innovation and this is really going to screw over the Russians, to, oh, that doesn't work anymore. They have adapted. And so it's measure, countermeasure. One Ukrainian described it as almost like fighting a mirror. And that's where, and if this is going to have, I suspect, far-reaching ramifications for warfare, including what the U.S. military does in future conflicts based on what they learn in Ukraine.
Well, there's so much more to talk about, but we have to take a quick break. Welcome back. I'm Charles Lane.
I'm David Ignatius.
I'm Jim Garrity.
And this is Impromptu. David, is this war winnable based on what you've seen in your various trips there and its current trajectory? Or is there some other outcome that we should be expecting? Can we even talk about Ukraine prevailing without recovering every square centimeter of the territory that Russia took? Talk to me about your endgame scenarios.
So it's hard at this point to imagine, even if Ukraine gets all the weapons we'd like to provide, it's hard to imagine them by force of arms driving the Russians out of all the territory that they've seized. What is possible is that they could put Russian-occupied Crimea at such risk that the Russians, to try to save Crimea, which I think is the crucial area for them, might enter a negotiation in which there'd be some ambiguous status for Crimea. I keep wondering whether Ukrainians would want to talk with me about a Korea solution. You know, the Korean War ended in an armistice. It was a military stalemate. And behind that armistice line, South Korea grew into one of the world's most prosperous countries. So you'd think, gosh, maybe the Ukrainians would want to think about that. I asked Zelensky that, and he said, what do you mean, North Korea? You want us to be North Korea? So he's not interested. And I think the Ukrainians feel, even if they were willing to think about a negotiated settlement, Putin has no interest right now. He thinks he's on top. He thinks he's on a roll. I think somewhere, you know, in the deep fathoms of Putin's brain, he thinks he might get back to Kyiv. So much as Ukrainians want this terrible war to end, I don't see right now an opportunity for negotiations. If the Ukrainians have some more success, if they take out airfields in Crimea, maybe. Maybe, you know, people talk to me about 2025 as being the year of some kind of resolution, not this year.
Sometimes you hear that Korea scenario expressed as an East Germany, West Germany scenario, but sort of the same concept. Jim, where do you see this thing headed?
What I was hearing largely aligns with what David just said. Spoke to one Ukrainian official who would only speak on background. The one angle that's really intriguing to them is the Crimea Bridge. It's a very long bridge. There's one that's for train, one is for trucks. And ironic, considering what we just saw in Baltimore, but apparently this bridge is really, really hard to take down. The Ukrainians have managed to disrupt shipments over it for short periods, but the Russians are pretty quick about rebuilding it and getting it working again. If they could somehow take it out, take out the struts, bring it down in a major way, resupplying the Russian forces in Crimea would become much, much more difficult. But you know, they would need, one, the U.S. to supply the weapons. They probably would need Europe to keep supplying at the accelerated rate that they've done to step in for them. And they need more manpower. There's been, while I was there, and I imagine while David was there too, they're still debating this argument about lowering the draft age from 27 to 25. Now, to American ears, that sounds really old because we're used to people getting drafted at 18. The way it was explained to me is that the Ukrainians basically want the older brothers to serve in the war and the younger brothers to be around to do the rebuilding. And I think the idea also is that by 27, hopefully you've gotten married, you've had kids, and there's another generation of Ukrainians to fight for. So there's a logic to it, I think, to a lot of Western ears, not having people from 18 to 27 fighting the war seems like a strange waste of manpower. So, you know, Ukraine is really trying to fight with one arm behind its back between when does the U.S. aid supplies come, the delays in getting the stuff that we've promised so far. It's always a tall order for these guys. And it's kind of amazing that they've held out as long as they have, but it's not clear that time is necessarily on their side.
So after listening to you guys, I'm more reinforced than ever in my view that there's a lot riding on what happens in the United States in November 2024 because of the obvious tendencies of the Republican Party and Donald Trump in particular, sort of in an anti-Ukraine and vaguely pro-Russia way. And I mean, that's sort of the elephant in the room we haven't spent too much time on. David, what are your takeaways from this conversation?
So my takeaway from my visit and from my talk with Jim is a feeling I had as I was walking out of Zelensky's office. If only more Americans, and I mean in particular more Republican members of the House of Representatives, could hear what I just heard, this would surely go differently. And these are people who are fighting incredibly bravely and resourcefully, and they're not asking for all that much from the United States. You know, we've been their ally. We've been supporting them as they've resisted an invasion by a country that's so arrogant. It would redraw the map in Europe if it could. And you just end up thinking, if the United States fails to meet this challenge, if Congress in the next few weeks doesn't act, we're really going to be the lesser for it as a country, and we'll be seen to be the lesser for it. I can just imagine Zelensky shaking his head as he hears bad news from Congress. So I hope that doesn't happen, because it'll hurt our country if we fail this one.
Jim?
Yeah. In the beginning of the war, I remember seeing this headline, probably was in the Post, where it talked about the war had launched a new struggle for global supremacy. And you keep hearing people referring to this as the largest land war in Europe since World War II. And I usually cover U.S. domestic politics. I am not a war correspondent. I'm not like David, who's been around every trouble spot in the world. But I just, felt compelled, like, wow, okay, so all these things you read about as a, but going back to World War II, this is the grand struggle between a free people and an oppressor nation in straight up, raw, naked military aggression. We're bigger and stronger. We can take over, and there's nothing you can do about it. And up until, for the first part of the 2 years of this war, the U.S. was very clear saying, no, we're going to stand with our ally. We're going to send them weapons. But look, there are times where it's a hard call between two warring parties, and this seems straight up good and evil. I'm not saying the Ukrainians are perfect, but man, oh man, the only thing they did wrong was be born in the wrong place and live next door to a country with a leader who may have gone nuts during COVID and who basically has dreams of restoring the Russian Empire. If we don't want to help these guys, what are the odds we're going to help Taiwan? How reliable an ally are we going to be to Israel, to anybody else in this world? And I think that to Donald Trump and a bunch of his supporters, that's fine. We're going to be isolationists now. We're going to build our wall. and whatever happens beyond our borders isn't our problem. Well, the problem is that at some point skyscrapers in your cities get, you know, airliners smashed into them. At some point, Pearl Harbor gets attacked. Problems that are over there don't stay over there. It would be a lot easier with this world if that was the case. So to me, like, you know, if we're not going to help these guys, what are we doing? What's the point of the United States of America if we're not going to help folks like this?
Thank you both for joining me for this really special episode of Impromptu.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Chuck.
This episode was produced by Hadley Robinson, edited by Damir Marusik, Chris Solentrop, and Allison Michaels, and mixed by Emma Munger. Chris Rukan designed our art. Special thanks to Millie Mitra, Nick Safin, Renita Jablonski, and David Shipley. Find Impromptu wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, please follow us, rate us, and leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you.